Welcome to Literary Quest, a podcast hosted by us, Vicky and Marissa, where we discuss our favorite in fantasy fiction and hopefully can direct you in your quest to find your next great read.
Welcome to Literary Quest. Today we're going to be discussing The Atlas Six by Libby Blake. I'm going to start with characters and Marissa will do our plot. So we have Libby. She's in her early 20s. She just graduated from magic school. She's one of the most powerful and one of the smartest people in the school. She's able to manipulate objects and is slowly discovering that she can actually manipulate time as well. With the right partner, she has stopped time and created wormholes. She has a boyfriend named Ezra who sucks. She's a giant ball of anxiety and is fueled by the need to do better than Nico. So think Anne of Green Gables, but much meaner. Then there's Nico. He's also in his early 20s. He graduated with Libby and he got the internship that she wanted. Just like Libby, he's able to manipulate objects in the space around him. Unlike Libby, however, he does not have severe anxiety and is therefore more popular. It's also pointed out several times in the book that he isn't that tall, so I feel like I should make a specific mention of that. He is very good friends with Gideon Drake, a half-mermaid, half-satyr dreamwalker. And Nico is also friendly with a fellow recruit and sparring partner, Reyna. Reyna is quiet, but she's not shy. She mainly just likes to keep to herself. She's a naturalist, which means that she acts sort of as a battery for others, and she can communicate with plants, and they call her Mother. And we have Callum. He is an empath without empathy. He has also illusioned himself to look like he has blonde hair, blue eyes, so nobody really knows exactly what he looks like. He tries to manipulate everyone, and is somewhat successful. He can alter their emotions. For example, he makes Libby calm down at one point. He also hates Libby because of her anxiety and wants to kill her. He is friends with and maybe has feelings for fellow recruit Tristan. Oh, Tristan. So Tristan, he came from an abusive home and was often told he was worthless, both in his ability and as a person. He can see through illusions to a new structure of reality. However, no one really understands what that means. He has managed to stop time with Libby and has seemingly traveled to another plane. He is very cynical to the point that it can border on paranoia. He had a brief fling with fellow recruit Parisa. Parisa is incredibly smart and beautiful. She's a telepath and can easily fish out most people's thoughts and secrets. She uses her beauty to help lower defenses. She is one of the more aloof members and she does not like to work in a group, as she does not trust them. She has been seducing and having an affair with Dalton to get information out of him without his knowledge. So Dalton is a member of the Alexandrian Society and a guide for the recruits. His affair with Parisa results in her learning secrets about the society. He's kind of like a necromancer, but with objects. He can like bring objects to life. So that's his power. And we have Atlas. He's the current caretaker of the Alexandrian Library. He's just suspicious. So the location of this book, there's some scenes in Manhattan, but for the most part, it takes place in the Library of Alexandria, which moves around and is currently somewhere in England. Okay. Those are our characters and locations.
Okay. So basically, this book is like The Matrix, but with access to untold knowledge of the Library of Alexandria via membership to a secret society of super powerful people and talented magicians that are called the Society. The caretaker of the Society's archives, who is named Atlas, is tasked with picking six extraordinary candidates for membership, which is something that only happens once a decade. He selects Nico and Libby, who are both talented physicists that can manipulate physical objects and other aspects of being. Callum, who is an empath, Parisa, who is a telepath, Reyna, who is a naturalist, and Tristan, who can see through illusions. They are given the opportunity to learn from what books the library is willing to give them, while also studying under the tutelage of Atlas and his helper, Dalton. However, all is not as it seems with the society, and each candidate is approached by members of an outside institution called the Forum, which is a group of magicians who believe that all knowledge should be available to the public and not gatekept by the elite. Things get even sketchier when they all learn that to be initiated into the society at the end of the year, one of them must die, be it through sacrifice or murder. Knowledge is carnage, but is it worth killing for? Who will die? And what will our candidates do? Spoilers abound. This book was a trip.
Oh my god, right?
Yeah, it was pretty wild, especially the last like 75 pages or so.
Yep.
Yeah, the things got a little bit crazy. I liked it a lot more than I anticipated.
Same. I wasn't sure. When I started, I had a little bit of trouble getting into it. And I think it's because there was kind of like an info dump at the beginning.
Yeah.
That was actually helpful. I went back and reread it like later on in the book. But.
Yeah. I did not expect to enjoy this book the way that I did. And at the end of it, I mean, again, I was just so shocked because a lot of times we read books that have sequels and we don't ever go on to the sequels. But I borrowed the second book from my library as soon as I finished the first book. Yeah. It didn't end on like a cliffy, but it ended with enough like setup for the next book that I was ready to get right into it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But also, like, I don't know how to express how indignant I felt that the author made me feel sorry for and not hate one of the characters that I hated for almost the entire book. Callum is a dick. I have like five notes in my Kindle app where I've highlighted something that Callum has said and commented, I hate him. He's the one that needs to die. I hope he does die. And at the end of the book, I felt bad for him and didn't hate him. I still don't really like him. But I didn't hate him.
Yeah, by the end, I didn't hate him either. I still didn't like him. And I don't know if I necessarily felt sorrow for him or like sorry for him or bad for him. I was just like, okay, I guess he's not all shit.
Yeah. But I agree. Like, even after I finished, like, I was so pumped up when I finished the story because it was just wild. Like, I was ready. Like, I was anticipating having this conversation. I was so excited to talk about it.
Me too.
Yeah.
I was like, I started it one day and then I was like, okay, I'm gonna sit down and I'll read some of it and then I'll finish it the next. I ended up just blowing through the whole book. Yeah. Almost. I picked up around 30% and then just like blew through the rest of it.
Power read. Yeah.
Yeah. And it wasn't even like on purpose because I was planning to take my time, but I was like, I need to know that Callum dies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I got way more into it than I thought I would. And especially because there are so many different points of views.
Yeah. I think this is the most points of view I've read in a story. There's seven, including Ezra. And so I expected the story to feel really disjointed because it does occur from so many different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And I felt like it flowed together really well. There was great continuity in the chapters.
I agree. And I think also for the most part, the author was able to keep like the characters' voices very separate. Like you could give me the book and like in the middle of a chapter and be like, oh, this is probably Raina or this is probably Libby. I think the only characters that I had a little bit of trouble distinguishing that I had to go back and remind myself were Tristan and Callum.
Yeah.
Which I don't know why, because Tristan's books are just all, I'm terrible.
Whoa, so pity. They should just kill me. I'm not special.
Like, yeah.
Bless him. I mean, it's sad.
It just, I,
how sad he is. In every, in his chapters and in Libby's chapters, I was thinking, y'all really need a therapist and someone to help you with your self-esteem, because wow.
Yes. Well, it was just, so I was reading it and I was like, oh, so one of my notes is, oh, he just needs somebody to love. And by that, I mean, he needs therapy, lots and lots of therapy.
Lots of therapy, yes. Now, towards the end, we have some romantic connections between Libby and Tristan. And I, as a couple, I like the idea of them. But if they were an actual couple in real life,
Oh, that'd be terrible.
it would be absolutely catastrophic. Neither of them has the self-esteem to be in a relationship with the other.
Good point.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Did you have favorite chapters?
I think so. So I actually think
Or characters, like character chapters.
character chapters. Yeah. So I liked Libby's chapters and I like Paris's chapters
Yeah.
a lot. I was surprised by how much I, because her chapters, because I wasn't sure how we're supposed to like feel about her as a character. Like when she was introduced, I was like, are
Yeah.
you like me or what? So I ended up
Yeah.
really liking her chapters. So what about you?
Yeah, I love Parisa's chapters. I have several notes in my notes that say Parisa remains my favorite. She, I think, is probably, her and Libby are my favorite characters, I think. Even though Libby's chapters get, oh, a little bit bogged down in her inner thoughts. I felt like Parisa's chapters were really interesting, and I also feel like her chapters move the story along pretty well, because she, like, the stuff that she does with Dalton and figuring out the things about the society, and even the this wasn't her chapter, it was Callum's chapter, but her interaction with Callum, where they have their sparring. The pieces with Parisa feel like they move the plot along.
Yes, I completely agree with that. Yeah, because we definitely had some chapters where not a ton happened, but
Yeah.
all of her chapters were very well thought out and did move. Like a lot of the things revealed came from her chapters, if not
Yes.
most of them, because she, well, she, you know, she can read everybody's mind, but she's also good at getting sneaking past their defenses.
Right, she is
Right.
good at getting what she wants.
And she
Yeah.
does it in a way where she's not Callum.
Right, yeah, she's not talking people into dying.
Yeah, she does it in a much nicer way. Liked her.
Yeah, I did too. But I think that's what makes the difference between, because Callum a couple of times says to Parisa, like, you just don't like me because we are the same. And she's like, we're not the same. But
A little bit.
similar idea, different approach, which makes a big difference in terms of likability. Yeah.
I think it was also interesting with the chapters and the characters is that you could kind of tell their ages almost. Like Libby and Nico's came, and even Reyna's to an extent, came across kind of naive a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, you could tell that they were young, especially Libby, because Libby was
Oh,
right
yeah. So you see,
there with her.
achiever complex, and Nico and Libby, but especially Libby.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely, I don't know if you, I, oh, when you spend a significant amount of time in academia, transitioning out of that is hard. So you can, you definitely get the, I mean, Nico and Libby have just graduated from grad school. So
Yeah.
for them, this whole endeavor is just like going into another group project.
Right.
For everyone else, it is not that. And so let's just, I don't know. For anyone who's ever worked in a group or had a school assignment that they've done in a group, Nico and Libby are trying so hard to be team players, and nobody else is having it. And that youthfulness, that approach, that definitely comes through.
Yes. I'm just trying to think of now if somebody tried to stick me in a group project like this, I would not, yeah, it would be, I would not go for it.
Yeah.
I'd do it, but no.
with a bad attitude.
Yeah, I would have an attitude about it.
Yeah.
Like, I thought I outgrew this.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked Nico's chapters too, but not because I was especially fond of Nico. I liked his interactions with Gideon, his friend.
Yes.
I loved that. I will not accept anything other than Gideon and Nico being in love with each other.
I know. Oh,
They have to be.
Absolutely. No way they're not.
There's no way.
Yeah. The book at first seemed like it was set up to be like an enemies to lovers sort of thing, and that quickly
I know.
changed.
Yes, I thought the same thing. Like, is this going to be Libby and Nico ending up together? No. No. But I'm so curious about Gideon because he is like the, you know, I was thinking of, is it Mendel and his pea plants when we learned about genetics, right? He is the two recessive genes. He is the bottom right corner of a of the pea plant chart. My mom's a mermaid. My dad's a satyr. I'm a human.
What are the odds?
With narcolepsy.
Gosh. At least yeah. He's like a dreamwalker on top of being a narcoleptic. Could you imagine being a narcoleptic and also not being a dreamwalker?
No.
That'd be terrible.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's kind of terrible for him because his mom uses him to sneak into dreams to steal from people.
Well, yes.
He gets punished in dreams, which is a terrible place to be punished because the imagination is a terrible place sometimes.
Oh, I must have missed that. I thought he was just
yeah. No, his mom, that's part of why she's interested in getting in contact with him. He steals information through dreams.
Right. Yeah, like Inception.
Yeah. So there he when he first when he got older and started doing it, he realized that there could be consequences for that. So Nico makes the comment about how he didn't sleep for like a month because the people that he stole from would find him in dreams and punish him.
Okay. Yes. I remember that now. For some reason, my mind went to his mom's punishing him in his dreams, and I was like,
no.
I remember that
No.
Happening. Okay. So.
His mom doesn't think about him unless she needs something.
His mom seems not cool.
Dysfunctional.
A lot of these characters seem to come from dysfunctional families.
They do. There is a lot of dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
So, we don't know Callum's family, Tristan's family, Parisa's family, what we learn of it sounds pretty dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm. Raina's family,
yep. Nico and Libby sound like they have pretty functional families, but Libby's childhood was colored by trauma, death of her sister, so. Yeah. Yeah. Were Callum's chapters your least favorite?
Yeah.
Yeah. His and Tristan's chapters were probably mine. Tristan's chapters felt odd to me.
Okay, that's my note too. I was like, I feel like he's confused. And I'm reading this through the lens of somebody who understands about like 70% of what's going on in this book.
Yeah.
That is how I felt every time I read his chapters. And I was just like, I like you, but you need a lot of help. But also, what is happening in your brain? Because what's happening?
Yeah. I also felt like in terms of what we learned about characters from these chapters, we learned a lot about like Libby and Nico in particular, and a little bit about Parisa because of that one chapter where she spars with Callum.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like these other chapters were very revelatory in terms of the characters overall, which I suppose may be something to come in future books.
Yeah. Raina, I felt like super underdeveloped.
Yes, I don't know anything about her. I feel like right at the end, we started to understand that she's like a battery in terms of her abilities, right? As a naturalist. Mm-hmm. Like, she can't use her powers, but everybody else can use her powers.
Yeah, like, if they touch her, they get more of a surge.
Yeah, like a boost, yeah. But she can't use that for herself. Just like the battery. But other than that, like very minimal information about her.
I know when
so
I was.
Maybe we do get more of that.
Yeah, I'm hoping so. Because when I was writing the descriptions, I was just, I don't have anything to say about her.
Yeah.
You just don't know much.
Yeah.
But could you think about what it's like to have plants talk to you, though?
Oh my gosh. So her chapters were like when the plants are talking to her, the commentary is hysterical. Mother, 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 mother is angry. Like hiking would be hell.
Well, in one of the chapters, I don't remember who it was, but they're like picking up blades of grass and then they cringe and they stop because they start thinking about how Raina's right there and is probably hearing like the grass scream.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine being around a forest fire? Like,
oh,
she would have to live in a desert to get peace. So to experience that in real life would be misery, but it was pretty entertaining to read about the plants screaming out and communicating with her.
Yes.
She makes a really, there's a funny quote in here. Oh yeah. Somewhere in the museum's administrative office, a small fern dying of thirst let out a thin wailing scream. I mean, my plants would just be screaming at me all the time because I'm terrible at taking care of them.
I wonder how my cactus is doing. I remember to water it like 3 times a year. Things still
There you
alive.
go. It's doing its thing. I did really like the premise of this story. I felt like that was a unique idea. There's a secret magical society that guards the quote lost knowledge of the Library of Alexandria because humanity is too stupid to be entrusted with such vast and incredible resources. Like, that feels pretty accurate.
It does.
Would you want Donald Trump to get his hands on any of the information in this library?
No, I don't think I would want any of our politicians to get their hands on it.
Absolutely not. Capitalists ruin everything.
Absolutely. Keep it away from Bezos for sure.
For sure. And Elon Musk. I do not trust that man. This book was like a mind fuck. I mean, it was pretty wild. There were parts of this book where I had to stop and reread because I was like, what is happening right now? And I appreciated how the author put out like Easter eggs on the way to the end where things kind of imploded in the last like 75 pages. I also liked how this book kind of highlights how trash humanity is. All of these characters discover that they'll have to kill one of their companions to join this society. And that revelation is met with 5 seconds of horror, rapidly followed by acceptance. No one gonna fight it. Libby's the only person who really questions it. And even when she finally does come to the decision that Callum should die, her motivations are based more on fear of him, like his actual abilities, than the desire for the library's knowledge. She says something like, maybe some abilities are too dangerous to exist.
Yeah.
This is after he walks Parisa while in Nico's mind off the edge of the building. Right. And that reminded me of that chapter in Fourth Wing where the character's ability to read minds like manifests in a crowd and he is losing it and he is immediately murdered.
No, there was no like, let's take you to a quiet room sort of. It was just break your neck.
It was pretty intense. The comparable ability would be Parisa's ability, telepath, being able to read minds. But Callum really showcases, I think unintentionally, because he gets, it seems like, manipulated by Parisa, how dangerous being able to manipulate emotion really can be.
I know. That scene, to me, it was really interesting. So it ends. But so he was basically in Nico's head, right?
Yeah.
Like he used that as the setting and then like as the person's brain, and then he's waltzing with Parisa, and like says all these terrible things about her, reveals some stuff. Is that when he reveals she has a husband somewhere?
Yeah.
Reveals bad things about her brother, right? Then convinces like this dream, not dream version, but this inside the head version to just jump.
Yeah.
And that's terrifying. Somebody could do it. So at the end.
Well, and what's wild about that, nobody knew it was dream version, right? They didn't know until, like Nico didn't know it was in his head. Parisa manipulated the situation. Callum thought it was real life.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also terrifying. I mean, yeah.
It's terrifying. Sort of like, actually, this does come up with Inception. Like, it is like, take something with you.
Mm-hmm. You know the talisman.
Yeah, the talisman. That's sort of that same theme here. And even in that, like, I want to call it like a dream sequence. That's not quite what it is, but you know. Libby's the only one who's like, don't do that.
Yeah.
Everyone else is just watching her jump.
Yes, just going along with it. Yeah, that's really wild. I think I've made this comment in my notes a couple of times. I think that Libby is probably the best of them, despite all of her anxiety and low self-esteem and things like that.
Yeah. I agree.
That she probably has the most attunement to a conscience. But bless her, she needs a therapist. And it's not even, she just wants to be accepted so badly. And I think when she uses her abilities, she's tremendously powerful and confident. It's just everything else.
Yeah.
She questions.
Yeah, well, you can see her. She becomes less anxious when she's using and like playing with her powers. Like when she had Tristan stop time.
Mm-hmm.
No. Basically, like right immediately before that, when she was nervous with him, and then she sits down and they figure out how to do it. All these nerves are gone. She's just focused on what else can we do?
Yeah. And her and Nico, like their relationship reminds me a little bit of like magnets, the way that they're attracted to and repel each other.
Mm-hmm.
Have this, like they work together and then there's conflict. They work together and there's conflict. They make a wormhole to get snacks, but then they go back to constant bickering. And like, I really enjoyed seeing their interactions, but it's also so tiresome because all they do is argue.
Mm-hmm.
Raina describes them as being binary stars. She says they were trapped in each other's gravitational field and each diminished without the other's opposing force.
So I get what she's saying.
Yeah.
And I do agree that they're kind of like trapped in each other's gravitational field. But I don't think that they'd be diminished without the other one around. I think for sure they push each other to be better.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think with one of them gone, the other one would also be lesser.
I don't think that they would be less powerful. I think that when they work together, they have so much more potential. Mm-hmm. To create.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what, because it's almost like Nico will thrive off of knowing that Libby will criticize him if he does something one way or something like that. And that's what drives him to test things out more.
Yes, there was, I highlighted it in the book. There was something, it was like, it was no fun to be mischievous if there's no one there to scold you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Libby is enough of a force on her own that she doesn't need him to, because like what she does with with Tristan,
mm-hmm.
she does without Nico. But I do think that Nico needs that push, that competition,
mm-hmm.
to really become all that he could be.
Yeah. I definitely don't think they would have gotten as far as they did without each other.
Yeah.
You know, each one trying to be better than the other.
Right. And I like their relationship is almost like a, I don't know if I would call it a bare minimum friendship or like a begrudged friendship or whatever. Like Nico, really obviously, I think both of them care for each other. They just are so bent on being competitive with each other that I think it gets in their way. So like Nico is the one that tells her about death being a consequence of them entering into the society. And he's like, look, don't ask me a bunch of questions about this, but just so you know, one of us is gonna die. Like, yeah, I don't know. I like their friendship. I hope they get a little bit less antagonistic in the next book because it does get tiring to read, though.
So some of the things that Nico said, I was surprised at, like about her. So he said things that were pretty deep. He says that one of them was like the day that the like you're not the fire or something. Shoot. I don't remember now, but and I was like, I didn't quite like in their interactions, didn't really get the depth of that emotion, you know?
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about because I highlighted you are a fire hazard, Rhodes. So stop apologizing for the damage and just let the fucker burn. Was
Yeah.
that it? I
No,
loved that phrase.
I highlighted that as well, but what I highlighted, what I was talking about was he says, the day you are not a fire is the day the earth will fall still for me. And I'm
Oh, yeah.
very sweet, and I just didn't get that vibe from him though.
Yeah, well, that's where that feeling of like, is this going to turn into enemies to lovers? I think comes in through, right? Because he's like, he doesn't like her choice of boyfriend. He's not good enough for her. He's boring, but he also doesn't like her. And so, like, you just can't stand the mediocrity. You want her to do better with a boyfriend. So, you get like, what are you going to complain about then?
Yeah.
Yeah, it felt like sibling relationship almost to me.
Yeah. I think they're better platonic.
Something that I really liked about Parisa was the way that she used her ability for telepathy plus her abilities with sex to get answers. I feel like we get so much rhetoric about if women aren't pretty enough, they're spurned by society, but if they're beautiful and they know it and they use it, then they're shallow. And if they use their beauty and sex to take advantage, or to not even just to take advantage, but to their own advantage, then they're a slut. We don't fault people for using other facets of their body or personality, like being really charming and being successful in business in the same way that we do people who are beautiful and know it. And I just love that she really embraced both of those things about herself and that she used her beauty and the mental vulnerability that people experience during sex to acquire answers. And it also feels like she is literally the only one amongst them who is trying to gain like any useful knowledge about the people they've indentured themselves to.
Oh, she is the one who seems like she is the most like un understanding that this isn't like of what's going on.
Yeah, this
General.
is not all that it seems.
Yeah. It's like she came in there and was like, something's not right. Where everyone else, well, not everyone else, but a bunch of other people came in and we get to learn stuff, which great. But also, what's happening to that sixth person?
Yeah.
Think about that. She thought about it. She figured it out. She knew like almost immediately about Callum being terrifying.
Yes.
To stay away from him.
Her side quests with Dalton were really interesting too. This is when we start seeing that there's something else going on in this library besides just the quest for knowledge.
Right.
Right? So at first I felt like defensive of Dalton because just the way like her approach felt so invasive, but by the end it seemed like she started to care for him, like she's genuinely concerned about whoever's been fiddling around in his head.
Yeah.
And then she goes into his head as like a test and finds things that she was not supposed to find. And Atlas pulls her out of Dalton's head, which is immediately a red flag.
I know. As soon as they said about him, when they were like, well, normally a caretaker, like, that's not normally how a caretaker is hired or whatever. I went, yep. There's something.
Suspicious. Don't be suspicious. Don't be suspicious. Very, very suspicious.
So, Frieza, right? Her character. So when it started, I don't know what the author was trying to like portray to us as readers with her, because she comes across as not being very nice, right?
Right.
As being kind of aloof. And I get it. She's a telepath. She can read everyone's brain, everyone's mind, and they're all probably thinking, about how she looks and judging her immediately. But I wasn't sure. I felt like weird. I was, does she want us to like this character? Does she not want us to like this character? Then we gotten her point of view and definitely liked her more. But even so, I mean, I guess she didn't have to. I thought she was gonna integrate herself more into the group towards the end. Didn't quite do.
I do feel like there's a lot of character development with her. Again, she's one of the ones that I feel like we got more information about. She's still very elusive and mysterious, and we don't know the same amount as we do, but I feel like overall, in terms of intention, we have a better idea of her character.
Yes.
As a character, I like that she's committed to figuring out what the hell is going on with these people too. Like, the number one rule of joining a cult is to know the price of admission. None of these suckers bothered to ask. Like, someone gets eliminated, six people go in, five people get to join. No one's like, well, I wonder what eliminated means. Did they really think there would be no strings, that fifth person or sixth person would get to like go home?
I understand Libby and Nico thinking that.
Well, they're children.
Exactly, they're children. I don't know, cults, they suck you in, right? Like, gosh, the Kool-Aid one.
Oh,
Is
yeah.
Jonesboro?
Not Jonesboro.
That's not it.
That's in Arkansas.
Yes, that's just the place. Anyway, they bring you in and then they go, you also have to die.
I know that people don't know they're going into a cult most of the time when they go into a cult, but logical thinking would tell us if you're being initiated into a super secret society and you're told six people will join and five will be initiated, the normal question to ask is, well, what happens to that fifth or that sixth person? There are always going to be strings. So even if the price of admission isn't somebody has to die, it could be brainwashed, brain wiped their magic. So are you even able to go back to who you were? Will you remember who you were before? The questions that you should ask before you join a super secret cult.
Well, and then that was the problem, though, is the two they weren't given a ton of time to think about it. It was like this offer expires in 20 minutes, sort of thing. I probably would have turned it down just on that. Like, no,
That's fair.
anything that tells me I need to make a decision in 2 hours is not, I don't want that.
As far as Tristan goes, we kind of talked about how we don't like his chapters just seem kind of muddled. I still don't really completely understand his abilities either. So he can see through illusions, but can he also manipulate like dark matter time?
So my interpretation of it is that he can see through illusions, and that, but like where we are or where they are, like time and space and like our regular plane of existence could be considered illusions. That's my interpretation of it. I could be wrong, but that's what I did in my head with it, that they're all different forms of illusions and he just needs to practice sort of.
Manipulating them.
Yeah.
As a character, he was a Debbie Downer.
Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of Charlie Brown a little bit. I feel like dating him would be like dating a wet sock.
I think this quote sums it up really well. Maybe after a lifetime of being useless, Tristan simply wanted to be used.
Yeah.
That sounds, that's, yep.
Tristan needs help.
Go to therapy, please.
Go to therapy, Tristan.
Like, just read like an article from Psychology Today at this point, you know? just anything.
I did think it was interesting how, you know, Callum kind of singled him out as one of the people that he could be friends with, which I thought was interesting because Callum was so rough. And he talked about Libby's anxiety and how untenable it was, but I would not want to, well, and you know, they all have up their shields, like mental shields or whatever, but being able to feel Callum's feelings, or Tristan's feelings. Yeah.
He says, so when Tristan is like about to kill him, right? That's when Callum manipulates Tristan's emotions, I think, for the first time. Or that he was like, that's what it's like.
Yeah.
I was messing with you, basically. So, I mean, he never, I guess, messed with Callum. There was, or not mess, gosh, Tristan. I don't know. There was some reason he liked him.
Yeah.
He seemed into each other.
Yeah.
Tristan is just because, bless his heart. But I feel like Callum does things with more strategy. And I couldn't really,
oh, yeah.
I don't really know what the strategy was behind Tristan, other than maybe he saw him sort of as a weakest, like a weaker link. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, I probably like in terms of the people he could tolerate too, because Callum was pretty obnoxious. Like, obviously, he couldn't interact with Libby because he can't stand her. There's no way Parisa would tolerate him because she hates him. Interacting with Nico like that would be like interacting with a puppy all the time. And Reyna was pretty closed off. Tristan was kind of one of the ones that he could. I think there might also be some comfort in interacting with Tristan as well, because Tristan can see through Callum's illusions, right?
Yes, that's
There's
right.
Not really any hiding from him.
Yes, he's the only one who knows what Callum really looks like.
Yeah. Yeah, Callum makes a joke about an empath being a psychopath. Is that really that far of a leap, though?
No. No. Not for him.
No. I found that the scene where he and Parisa spar was a great scene, but it was really alarming to me. The way that he manipulated Parisa into just walking off the side of the building. And the way that, you know, we learned that he manipulates one of the spies that break in on their first night into killing themselves too.
Yep.
And I think he has a good, like, an interesting conversation with Tristan about some of that interaction, where he says, like, we show mercy to people basically when they have terminal illnesses. When he's talking about Parisa's feelings, he makes a comment about how, like, she's suffering, people, she's experiencing pain, her condition is unending and it will not change. It is terminal, basically, her feelings, her pain. Do we not extend the same sort of response when it's emotional pain versus physical pain? Which I thought was an interesting point to make, because that's something that we see when people struggle with really severe mental illness.
Yeah, and there are, I don't think it's in the US, there are places that are now, they can go through doctors, and if you really can't, if you're basically diagnosed with chronic depression, that's just absolutely miserable. You can basically do euthanasia or death.
Yeah. Physician assisted suicide.
Thank you. Physician assisted suicide. I feel like euthanasia is such a tough term for it.
Yeah.
Oh. But yeah. Yeah. There are some people with that happening because they're just miserable. They can't enjoy life, they can't enjoy anything. But I don't think that's necessarily the case with Parisa.
No, yeah, no, because that's not the person making the decision to do that. That is Callum basically committing murder through manipulation.
Yes.
So after everybody gets alarmed by his approach with Parisa, she's not actually dead. But nobody trusts him. Nobody's wary, like everybody's wary of him. So he changes tactics. And he tells Tristan a story about how he could tell his mother didn't love him when he was 5 years old. And so he made her love him. And then he talked about the things that he did to stay alive. He says, I feel immensely, but I have to do it differently. And I think that that is a really relatable, or just something that not relatable. Like, I can't, I'm not an empath. I don't have magical abilities, but I just think about how, like, I can barely tolerate my own feelings sometimes. So bearing everybody else's feelings as well, it would be exhausting and terrible to feel everyone's feelings all of the time. So I can understand how he would have to create safeguards for himself. But he definitely only started acting this way and showing any kind of vulnerability after everyone turned on him, which makes it just feel like a chess move, like he's manipulating things again.
Mm-hmm.
You said you were suspicious of Ezra the whole time. Is that right?
Yeah, that dude, there was something not right, like right off the bat. He was too much.
Yeah.
I guess. I knew there was something off with him, and like, yeah, he gave off vibes.
Yeah.
What about you?
I mean, he definitely came off as like a stage five clinger.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't expecting him to have some role in the larger plot, though, until we got to that thing with the interlude. And I was like, oh, okay, well, this wouldn't be in here for no reason. And then, like, the second to last chapter, I think, is titled Ezra. So, like, he's the one narrating the story. So, obviously, there's got to be something else going on there, because otherwise he would not get his own big chapter like that. Yeah. I was not expecting him to be working with Atlas the whole time to orchestrate the fall of society and maybe the end of the world as a whole.
Did not get that. I got the, wow, he's really pushy. There's something fishy going on. Not the let's destroy the world vibe.
Sort of, yeah. Thing.
Although I dig that vibe. So.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty... It's a pretty sizable twist there.
Yes.
I saw somewhere that this book was compared to the Umbrella Academy, and I wondered where that was going to come into play, and this is it.
I've never seen it or read it. Wait, it's
just... I know. I only watched like the first two episodes, and then I gave up. But I know that there's an apocalypse coming, and someone gets lost in time. Other twist that I was not expecting was the Parisa, Libby, Tristan threesome. It was a really unanticipated element in this story.
That's not where I saw this book going either.
No. And we had it was just disappointingly vague, I'll be honest.
Mm-hmm.
There's like, she talks about tongues and licking and things like that. No description.
Nope.
Yeah, disappointing.
Is he eating ice cream? We don't know.
Yeah, I like what was happening. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Who got penetrated? No idea.
It's like Poppy.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, but more vague. And yeah, you know, that's not like surprising. Not surprising given the kind of book that this is. This is not a romance novel, but still, I wanted.
If you're gonna have a sex scene, and it's not like YA sort of thing, you know, with fade to black.
Yeah.
A couple paragraphs. Get into it.
I did really appreciate some of Parisa's comments to Libby in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
Libby asks Parisa why she uses sex and her beauty to get answers with her abilities. And Parisa says, because I enjoy it.
Yep.
And basically, if people are willing to pay for it and it costs money to live in this world, then why not do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is great. Libby asks her if it's demeaning, and Parisa says, it's attitudes like yours that make sure I will never be denied. She says, men in particular are draining. They bleed us dry. They demand that we carry their burdens and fix their ills. A man is constantly in search of a good woman, but what do they offer us in return?
Mm-hmm.
And I like this comment because she goes on to discuss having like emotionless sex,
mm-hmm.
which I feel like is the thing that we tend to attribute to men.
Right.
They want to have emotionless sex. And the rhetoric is always that women can't have sex without having feelings. And we have a character who's saying, yeah, you can. You don't have to commit. And that's true in real life without magician people. Any gender can have emotionless sex. I also like this because I think we're hitting, so in return to this, like that comment, men are draining, a man is constantly in search of a good woman, but what do they offer us in return? I think that we've reached a phase of existence recently where women have a lot more financial and social freedom, although the US government is doing its damnedest to kind of take some of that away. But anyway, so where men were like just existed and found female partners years ago because women needed them for financial stability and support, women don't need men for that anymore. Which means that women are now looking for better men or no men. And so instead of men just having the ability to exist and get a partner now, they have to like actually put in the work on themselves.
Yeah. And men don't want to.
Yeah. And so we're seeing this issue with adapting to that. It seems like statistics indicate that the happiest and most successful women are childless and single. And that suggests that maybe the menfolk are not as adapting as well. Even really think that that's their fault. I think that's probably a function of like toxic masculinity and patriarchy. And so I think because we're seeing this shift now, maybe in a generation or two, we'll start to see men trending in that direction where they have put in the work.
Yeah, I definitely think I don't even want to say that it's, I mean, there's definitely some pushback, I guess, on trying to, like, society itself just promotes toxic masculinity, right? The whole don't cry, you know, or you feel like a girl sort of thing, you want, like, you know, that sort of stuff. And it does seem like we're moving away from that. I definitely see it with my nephews. The world is definitely moving away from that sort of talk and that rhetoric.
Yeah.
General, I have hope for the next generations. I'm hoping.
Yeah. Well, I think, and we see that in men now too, right? I think that we, you know, this is probably something that has been trending in this direction. So we're seeing it now, but the hope is that we see that as a majority type of mindset in the next generation. I know my sister-in-law does a lot of work with my nephews to teach them to be really sensitive and empathetic and to not conform to gender norms and expectations and assign, like, I remember like just assigning, like deciding that the color, because they're, you know, really young children, so not just saying like, oh, it's pink, it has to be a girl's.
Right. Yeah, my sister, she's also works very hard with her boys, and you can see it reflected in their actions and how they interact with the world.
Did you have some sketchy feelings about Libby and Parisa and Tristan's threesome?
Yeah, so I was a little bit, like, it seemed out of character for Libby. And then there was a little bit, they got her drunk, right? Or, I mean, like, so she drank, she chose to drink, but then there are also, like, a couple points where, like, they're tipping the bottle up for her to drink. And then Parisa's also in her head.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit like, this is, like, we're kind of in a gray area here.
Yeah.
You know, she also just came from a very emotional fight with her boyfriend.
Right? She had just broken up with Ezra.
Yeah.
And a like very dramatic, I am not yours.
Yes.
Slams the door, walks away.
Right. Yeah. So she's, you know, vulnerable. Parisa knows that off the bat because she can read her mind. And then she pulls her in, you know, they do everything. So I don't know. It was a little bit, you know, just slightly uncomfortable that way. I was like, this is we're a little in the gray area here. But and then we also don't know whether or not Libby regrets it. She doesn't address it in any of her chapters, I don't think, really, afterwards. No. And then in Tristan's chapter, where
He talks about how they woke up together, and she turns to him and goes, I don't want to talk about it. In fact, it's better that we just don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Kind of indicates there's some stuff like that she's not super thrilled with what happened.
Yeah, it is surprising, kind of based on how much time Libby spends in her head, that we don't get a full rundown of her thoughts on her experience with Tristan.
Or
it's any- really interesting too, because yeah, yeah, like any commentary at all. Mm-hmm. The right after they sleep together, she wakes up, or no, it's Tristan's chapter, so he wakes up and Libby's just like in bed,
mm-hmm,
next to him, awake, reading.
Mm-hmm.
Cool as a cucumber.
Which is because she's such a ball of anxiety.
Yeah.
Normally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So maybe she doesn't regret her decision.
Maybe.
She just maybe doesn't want to talk about it with him.
That's true.
I don't know. Yeah, there's definitely some sketchy consent there, especially because we see Callum interacting with Tristan later on, and Callum confronts Parisa about it, and she makes the comment about tipping the scales in her favor. Definitely. I mean, again, well, she's just using sex and beauty and telepathy in the way that we kind of talked about.
Mm-hmm. And poor Tristan, just anybody who shows him any attention, he just,
yeah,
be my friend.
He just,
mm-hmm.
Oh, Tristan.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, Tristan.
Feel bad for Libby for part of the story. She really seems to want to be accepted by the everybody.
Oh my gosh, everybody. I know. She... I know.
Yeah. Okay. And she, from the beginning, it's like, we should all be working together.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not. She can't get them to work together. So she kind of works and fits and starts with some of the other ones. And so when she finds out that the cost of admission is that someone has to die, mm-hmm, she goes and confronts Atlas about it. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't give her just a ton of information, but he does make a comment about how in some situations it is murder, but in some situations one person sacrifices themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought for sure that we were going to have a human sacrifice situation.
Same.
With Libby.
Mm-hmm. Definitely thought that was going to happen too.
Yeah. I'm glad that it didn't. And I, again, when they do decide to kill someone, it's Callum. And Tristan is the one that gets nominated to do it. Tristan tries and he doesn't succeed.
I don't like, I understand the reasoning why they gave it to Tristan, right? Because it had to be a sacrifice. So if Tristan killed Callum, it's a sacrifice.
Yeah.
But did they really think Tristan could do that?
Yeah.
Like, no.
No.
That was never going to happen.
No. I feel like fantasy fiction has changed the way that I think about the world. When we run into like these characters, they're running into this like situation with a suspicious governing body. It's a cult, society, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
They're told, well, to join, you have to kill someone. My first thought anytime with these dumb rules is like, that's stupid. Just burn it down. Who cares about conflict resolution or compromise? Who cares about your like rules? Like, just scorched earth the whole way. Yep. And apparently that's also what Alice and Ezra think, because that becomes their plan.
I did not expect that to be their plan.
I did not either.
Like, that was the plan. I was just like, what?
Yeah.
I'm here for it. Because, you know, that sounds entertaining, but
right.
Not what I thought was going to come out of your mouth.
No. Unanticipated, for sure. Mm-hmm. That they both, so Ezra's chapter, this is where, I mean, I could not put it down at this point. Ezra's chapter gets here and he starts talking about how he grew up.
Mm-hmm.
His mother was killed in a shooting in a church. And he learned how to walk through time. And then he gets commissioned, to join the society. And he meets Ezra and they hatch a plan. because fuck these elitist people in the society and the idea of having to kill someone to be part of it. We'll just dismantle it over time, find the perfect group of people to do it, and burn it down and start all over. Or make it whatever they want it to be. And that's what they do. That's where we've gotten to at this point. Ezra walks forward in time because things, you know, Ezra is able to, with his abilities, stay young while Atlas gets older. And so while Atlas is looking for these people, Ezra is just kind of hanging out in Libby's timeline. And then he walks forward into the future at some point because things start to get weird with Atlas. And realizes that they have, in fact, hit upon the apocalypse with the plan that they hatched originally.
Oops.
Yeah.
What you can do, sometimes you accidentally bring around the apocalypse.
Sometimes you do. And so now Ezra's plan is the damage control.
Yes.
Which he goes about doing, I guess, pretty cleverly. So right before he kidnaps Libby, we have my favorite Libby moment. She says, men conceptually are canceled. The society founded by men, I guarantee it. Kill someone for initiation, a man's idea.
Yes. I highlighted that too. I thought it was good.
Yeah. So she has this conversation with Nico. Nico's like, nah.
Naturally.
Yeah. She goes back to her room and gets kidnapped by Ezra. And he sticks her in this like pocket universe. He replaces her body with a fake Libby, dead body.
Not Libby.
And not Libby. Libby's outraged. And then she's stuck in a pocket universe. Ezra's like, I'll be back sometime. this scene was wild.
Yes, and what was really, and it was told from Tristan's point of view.
Yeah.
Not the point of view I would have expected.
No.
And I understand, I guess she did it because he can see through illusions.
Yeah.
Right? But, you know, it felt, especially because his chapters tend to be, like, just weird and kind of confusing. Like, he doesn't totally know what's happening all the time, which was really reflected in this chapter when he's looking at her body and is like, oh, she can't breathe facing that way. Which I get is, you know, sort of like a not expected, like, you know, he's like, oh, is that the problem? She's laying that way, or is the problem that her chest isn't rising, you know?
Yeah.
So the other thing I found interesting about that was that one of the reasons he recognizes it that it's not Libby's body is because she's a birthmark on the wrong side. And he has slept with her once and knows this. Ezra, they've been in a relationship for years, doesn't know where her birthmark is. I mean, you know, gosh.
Well, you know, those drunken threesomes will leave an indelible mark.
Apparently.
I mean, it sounded like it was on her leg or something, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, well, maybe Ezra's not super into oral and didn't spend a lot of time with his face between her legs.
Well, even more of a reason she should have broken up with him earlier.
True facts, ma'am. Absolutely. Yep. I also found it was like surprising. Tristan's vehemence in this scene as well. He is vehemently saying, that's not Libby.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's also, it's mentioned in it, and it uses this verbiage. So Nico is so upset, right? And Tristan is somewhat envious of them, like of the bond that they had. He says something along the lines of, oh, of like somewhat envious, of course, you know. Yeah, the bitterness Tristan tasted at the Tremors, however mystifying and incongruous, stemmed from his own envy because, of course, one would suffer the other's pain. The two of them were in orbit to something Tristan would never grasp or understand. And I'm just like,
just so sad.
So they begin the search of finding Libby. I do wonder, so you know, Dalton is the one that created the body or the animation that was Libby. Carissa asks him about it later on, and he was like, there's only one person I know of that could create something that looked like this, and it's me. Which means we've got some type of time warp happening somewhere. So I wonder, did Ezra travel forward at some point to get this create like animation of Libby? I feel like that has to be part of it. Maybe we'll find out in the next story.
Time's all wibbly wobbly.
Yeah, wibbly wobbly, timey wimey stuff. There's this trend on the internet right now where women ask men about Rome, how much they think about the Roman Empire. That is not a thing that I ever think about. But twice, comparisons or analogies involving Rome are mentioned in this story. One of the quotes is like, Rome falls, everything collapses, you will too. I never think about this. I want to know, like, what I think about is like the characters in Pride and Prejudice. How are they managing their periods in like petticoats and corsets? Like, what are we using for pads? What's happening?
Yeah, Rome is, I don't know why I meant to think of the Roman Empire. At least once a month, I think about eels. Like,
Yeah.
we don't know where they come from. We've never seen the mate.
Really?
Yeah, we don't know. Like, we've never seen the mate or anything. Like, the first time I heard about this, I thought it was fake. They just show up. They just
Fascinating.
show up. Why isn't we talking about this? Why is there not more research? Like, eels just show up.
I've never thought about eels, but now I'm gonna have to do some research. Is there anything else we want to say about this book?
Don't think so.
I mean, it wraps up with a lot of buildup for the next book. Everybody, they do like that, they all get initiated into the society. Everyone does, like, you know, the thing where they stand in a circle. Not really, but that's how I imagined it. And like one person puts their hand out, and then the other puts their hand on top of it. And then the other puts, you know, like in the circle. And they're like, are we going to do this? Because Nico's like, I'm not doing it without Libby. And Tristan's like, yeah, same. And Priest is like, yeah. And Rain is like, I'll do whatever you want, Nico. You're the least annoying person here. And Callum's like, fine. Yeah. So they all decide we're doing it for Libby and whatever else. Let's talk about our quotes. I had a favorite quote on this one. So my favorite quote, it was said by Nico about Libby right after she is taken. He says, I know exactly what shape she takes up in the universe. If anyone can recognize her, it's me. I just love the imagery that this crafted for me. My brain really appreciated this statement. It's something about, like, I really like the idea of being seen and known by people who are close to me, who are important to me. And I feel like despite all of the conflict and things that Nico and Libby have, like, he really sees her. And I feel like that's encompassed in this sentence. What about you?
I have, and I don't remember who says this, but I blame the society because if it is not its job to cause such atrocities, then why not undertake the effort to prevent them? Inevitably, it must stand to gain. Oh, this is the people from the forum. That's
Oh,
what
yeah,
they said.
definitely.
And I highlighted this because it's pretty true to life, right?
Yes, it is.
There's a reason that, we don't stop things from happening, and it's because, it's profitable.
Right.
That's my quote.
Good quote. Okay, that wraps up The Atlas Six by Olivia Blake. We are taking a break. We will be back on Halloween. Halloween is on a Tuesday this year. So October 31st, we will be coming back for a monster of a good time with a monster romance for the spookiest day of the year. And we hope that you join us. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to Literary Quest. We hope you enjoyed our episode. If you'd like to follow us on social media, we can be found at Literary Quest Podcast on Instagram or Facebook. You're also welcome to share your thoughts and ideas with us via email at literaryquestpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.